Ultra Wave. Surf with us.
Welcome to the fourth and the last episode of our Cultural Waves podcast, in which we discuss studying culture with Anton Dinnerstein, a Polonus Bees research fellow at the Institute of Slavic Studies of the Polish Academy of Sciences. Today we will focus on Anton's research. I think it's the part we've been all waiting for. Without future ado, let's listen to the first song, which is an interpretation of a poem, Ty pomnisz.
Наша мордела листья, соткали зоры сребра нить. У той ночи мы поклялись жить и любить, любить и жить. И мы жили, и мы любили, и несли праву и любовь. Часы дятины снова дыли, до нас не вернутся. Новых песен дум, и нужной сталости жаданий на нас печатку покладут. А что не вернется с годами, ни тая ночь, ни той настрой, что подавал да ты над нами, и над тобой, и надо мной.
Anton, as for your research, what are you actually studying and why did you decide to study this topic actually?
There is a research project that studies Russian language political discourse based on the Belarusian case, and this scene is about basically how people construct meaning about politics using specific cultural key terms in Russian. And then another research that I did for my dissertation was about public creativity, also based on the Belarusian case. And this was a bit different. It was more of an ethnographic study, like I was observing, you know, different grassroots communities, how they create basically new environments through communication and interactions.
Okay, I see. You mentioned public creativity, and what's that?
This is the thing that's basically how I approach it. I called it public creativity because I was studying public interaction and how people basically start doing something new in their everyday lives, introducing new routines, new everyday behavior and habits, how they learn these different habits and start behaving differently. And I mostly picked grassroots communities for this because it was something going on in Minsk. When I came back in 2015, I suddenly saw that there was something going on in public, a lot of things, like urban festivals, different cultural hubs and art communities, different business hubs, entrepreneurship projects. And people were kind of convening in different small groups, doing something new. And then it drastically changed the way the city looked, drastically changed what people did in public space. Like, for example, they created something different, like I mentioned, Peshekhodka before, this urban festival. And it was done in this reconstructed old part of the city, which is called Upper Town. And it was a summer festival which involved different producers, independent artists, and different enthusiasts who interacted with state properties and state authorities who were owning, controlling this place. People basically felt different where they somehow managed to create an environment where people basically felt different. Where if you go from a regular street, like you get inside this area and feel you are in a completely different environment, different world. It was like that, and in Belarus it's now much worse than it was back then when I studied it in like 2017 or 2020, for example. Like when it was all flourishing, all this independent culture.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And basically then people started creating environments for themselves in public space. For example, what do you call it, like a food court? But food court in a European city is something casual, right? It is everywhere. But in Belarus, where it was something new, it was surprising because you go there and you see, wow, it's interesting, like some food trucks, some music, some performers, people interact, chill in there, like completely without any restrictions. Basically, nobody controls it. At least it seems like nobody controls it. But then these environments were spreading across the country, these kinds of different types of behaviors, everyday routines, and then they became habitual, basically like taken for granted, banal things, and you don't even think about it. But then you go to this place, for example, to this food court, to listen to a musician, and you will always find somebody to talk to there. You'll meet people with similar interests. You will meet new people. And then out of this communication mode, of this connection, something new comes up, because people organize together and start creating some other art projects or business projects or something else. And then basically these environments were instrumental for people to feel free. One thing, and another thing, to find like-minded people with whom you can organize something else and expand this kind of environment across the country. And so this like public creativity basically means that through this interactions, people create different meanings about what they do in these public places, who they are. They create different practices when they learn how to be meaningfully present in these practices. For example, I don't know how to explain it better, but for example, they learn different types of behavior, and then these types of behavior become taken for granted and they reproduce them.
So they kind of recreate the meaning of certain practices, right?
Yeah, then more and more people are involved and more changes in these everyday routines happen. And this was how culture is transforming itself through this everyday basics, like banal things like going to a festival or buying a hot dog in a food truck, in a food court, for example. Because there are more and more people like you there, and you see that you are not alone and that you can actually do something to change an environment which you don't like. And this is how it was working. It still works, but it's more like underground. Many of these NGOs and independent activities were closed now because of the repressions. But still, like in the Soviet Union even, it always existed. There was underground movements, like some of that, for example, kvartirniki. It seems that people are convinced in somebody's apartment and, like, for example, like listen to rock music or recite poems or something like that.
So these everyday routines can be a powerful tool. Okay, let's hear the second composition based on a Belarusian poem, Adishoshim, performed by Naka.
На ваших могилах ми справим весіль, і душі зальем стародавнім вином. Успомнім, як дні наші в нетри летіли. Больше не вернуться николи и снова. Мы в майские ночи поплачем над вами, расскажем вам ваши почутки и сны, як серце квітнеє зарою огнями, як грають жадані на струнах весни. Рушучи у полі змертвілий свій боль. Там хвойка упала з надломаним криком, там свіжий кривий пролилася завтра. На заходу зняв хтось морозний піль,
жить, ми створяємо закони. Ми маримо об дальнє незнаній красе. У бойку йдем, помираємо з прокльоном. І смерть нам вянки на могилы несе. А може бути так, що просло дуня там. Но ми пойдем помру, ми не вернемся. Хтось буде на наших могилах весною співати за хапленням про щастя і волю.
Okay, so the second thing you were mentioning is that in your research you deal with political discourse. And what is it about? And why is it important in your case to research political discourse in general?
So this political discourse, at some point, well, it was like attending all these activities during the protests, what was happening in Belarus, like looking how people behave. What is happening, reading news, basically following these events. I was reading a lot of interactions online, speaking with people and reading a lot of news. And then suddenly I figured out that there are some key terms, like words, that come up in almost any political discussion. Like, for example, the word власть, power, or like народ, people, or государь, state, right? And then I say like, okay, there is something going on probably with this. And then it was Russian language political discourse. I was thinking maybe there is something happening with the Russian language, the way it is used to discuss politics. Because for me, it seems that somehow it reproduced the way people think about politics. Then when I started to look into actual news data and actual interactions, when I collected data, I figured out there are like 7 to 8 key terms that exist in more than like half of all these conversations. And basically, if you look at any text, there is a high probability you'll encounter one or several of these terms of this vocabulary, right? And then I say, okay, and why are you using these terms to speak about politics? Then if you try to follow this kind of, for example, linguistic roots of these words like власть or власти, and then all these things like that владыка, владеть, which means like, for example, the owner and master or something like this, and then the word power. In English, it translates as power, and in Russian, it becomes personal. But in English, it's an abstract, basically, notion. It's an attribute of somebody. And then you see probably there is this problem with language that people even don't normally attribute this kind of personal traits to people who control the government, for example. And then even if they oppose them, they still use the same language to name them, meaning that they think of power as an entity, as some kind of identity that it has. And then that's why they construct this opposition between people and power. And the problem with this is that this, when we speak about political processes in this kind of identity terms, attributing personality traits to things that are not supposed to have personality, like power or state, then the term state goes from the sovereign, and this is a person who also controls everything. So even linguistically, these words are rooted in connection with some kind of personality. Entities that can judge, can rule, can own basically everything, and then it opposes people in this discourse. So it's like the reproduction of this populist kind of way of thinking when you have this opposition in society. But for example, if you use English, you cannot say that power is against people. You can say people have power, right? Or say that president has power, or somebody gets power through votes. But in this case, you see absurdity. The power restricts somebody to do something.
Yeah, you cannot think about it in English, like power cannot restrict anything.
Indeed, somebody with power can restrict something, and then it creates this metonymic substitution, which is a logical fallacy. And this is what I found in this Russian language political discourse, that it is like prone to these logical fallacies, and people may not even know about this, that they use this logical fallacy. They employ this fallacy when they speak about politics, and they reproduced the understanding of politics based on this fallacy, meaning that you cannot think about politics without this kind of personality about power entities. And then I'm not sure what you can do with this, but probably you either need to change the language you use to discuss politics, or maybe at least understand what kind of meaning it can create. When you speak of politics in this way, you unwittingly basically give agency to something that is not supposed to have agency. And that's why maybe it's difficult to differentiate a president or person in power from the basic power that he gets from voting.
That is a very interesting insight into Belarusian politics, and let's hope that your research contributes to a better change. So let's say our goodbyes with the last poem.
Не быть скотом.
Performed by Ляпис.
Bye.
Bye.
Чого хочеш долі
лепшай?
Якої долі
хліба, солі?
Чого волі
землі, волі
хліба, солі землі, волі хліба, солі землі, волі?
Де народився
своєї
вёсці?
Де
хрестився
при дорожці?
Чим отвінчим?
Кров'ю, потом.
Чим быть хочеш?
Не быть скотом.
Кров'ю, потом. Не быть скотом. Кров'ю, потом. Не быть скотом.
Не быть скотом!